Hi, this is Steve Downes, the voice of Master Chief. You're listening to ThisWeekInGeek.net. Finish the fight.
Did you grow up with the NES, PlayStation, Star Wars, cartoons, and 80s TV? Do you like to think who would win in a fight between Batman and the Master Chief? Comics, games, movies, music, and TV. They're gonna tell you everything you need. Superheroes or not, they got your back. They're gonna save the world of geeks. Comics, games, movies, music, and TV. They're gonna tell you everything you need. Superheroes or not, they got your back.
Hey guys, what's going on? You're listening to This Week in Geek, and I'm your new Time Lord Traveler, Mike the Birdman Dodd. Well, guys, it's been a while since I've had a chance to sit down and do some interviews, and this would be one of the few times I've actually get a chance to talk Doctor Who. As you guys may know, there's a really cool event coming up in Toronto on Sunday, June 9th at the Popper's Pub. It's an afternoon with a guy named Gary Russell. We're going to learn a little bit more about him later in the show, but I got offered somebody else in the midterm to talk Doctor Who, and this guy has written a couple of different books. One of them you can pre-order called Who's 50, but the one he has right now is one called Who is the Doctor, which he wrote in conjunction with a man named Robert Smith, a guy who is actually responsible for that mathematical equation for the zombie apocalypse. I'm talking about Graham Burke. And what his book is about, it's basically looking through the first six seasons of the new Doctor Who reboot with analysis. How does it connect with, like, other storylines? Where are there what-the-hell moments, etc., etc.? And it's a very intense read. The fact that it reminds me very much of the old Star Trek Nitpicker's Guide or the X-Files Nitpicker's Guide. I really enjoyed reading this book. And, well, I got lucky enough to get Graham on the show. So without any further ado, let's welcome author Graham Burke.
Hi there. Great to be here, Mike.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you because when I read your book, Who is the Doctor? I wasn't quite expecting the level of detail that you go into in some of these episode synopses and the fact that you were able to connect it to old specials and everything, because my knowledge is only really limited to the new Doctor Who series.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's certainly what we wanted to do. We wanted to do a book that would welcome new fans into the world of Doctor Who, because it's a big, exciting world. And I think people sometimes get scared of past continuity and the big mythology around it. And there's nothing to be frightened about. It's a fun show that's full of comedy and adventure and all sorts of stuff, no matter what it is. And we wanted something that would be accessible, that would connect people to what the broader story of Doctor Who is and welcome them into it.
So I guess my question is to establish thy nerd cred outside of writing the book. Let's get a little bit of your origin story, Graham. Like, how did you get into writing, and then how did you land this Doctor Who gig? Because I imagine this might be a very awesome thing to get pretty much right off the hop.
Yeah, I've always wanted to be a writer growing up, and I had I work at my day job as a communications manager for a nonprofit agency, but I've always loved Doctor Who. It was my favorite television show since I was 14 years old, and I watched Pyramids of Mars, which is a Tom Baker story. I watched it off a local PBS station. I grew up in Oakville, Ontario, and we watched WNED Channel 17, and that's how I watched Doctor Who, and it was great. And, you know, fast forward 20 years, and I started just for fun to edit a fanzine for an organization called the Doctor Who Information Network. And I edited their fanzine Enlightenment, and I edited it from 2000 to 2010. And over that time, I I built up a fairly sizable body of work, and from that, my collaborator Robert Smith, who is a very old friend of mine, and I decided to collaborate on a collection of fanzine articles, which was published by Mad Norwegian Press, and it's still available from them. It's called Time Unincorporated, the Doctor Who Fanzine Archive, and we did two volumes of that, and one volume was fanzine articles about the classic series, and the other one was fanzine articles about the new series, and so we had two books, and I'd always wanted to see an episode guide to Doctor Who. I mean, you mentioned the Nitpicker's Guide to Star Trek, which I loved when I was much younger. And I also, there's a great Doctor Who book about the classic series called The Discontinuity Guide, which does something similar to the Nitpicker's Guide. And we just love both, but we never saw anything like that for the new series. And we wanted something that had that kind of sense of fun to it, but it was kind of engrossing and you just couldn't stop reading it, like the Nitpicker's Guide and the Discontinuity Guide. So, we had pitched it with a couple of publishers, and it hadn't quite taken root, but we were lucky that we went to the Polaris convention in Toronto. Robert was a guest on zombie stuff, and I was his plus one, and we went there, and a friend of mine said, oh, you should talk to Nikki Stafford. She's signing books, and she's done a series of guides for Lost for ECW Press. You should talk to her about doing that Doctor Who guide you're pitching. And so she was there, and I just we said, hey, look, you know, we've written two Doctor Who books, and we'd really like to do an episode guide to Doctor Who, and she said, yeah, sure, send us the pitch, and they loved the pitch, and the rest is sort of history.
Well, I'm really glad that there is something like this for new fans, especially because, like you said, a lot of people get really intimidated by 50 plus years of history kind of going into it. I mean, really, and with this year being the big 50th anniversary coming up in November, the property's unbelievably hot. It just seems like the fandom sprung up out of nowhere. Like, I think things really, at least in my observation, I think things really took hold during the third year of David Tennant, and it just seems like it just came alive right then. Like, you started hearing about it everywhere, and I do you remember when CBC used to carry the new Who series?
Yeah, I do, actually. We were quite, the organization I'm a part of, the Doctor Who Information Network, was quite involved with CBC in putting out. They're a really great web team that really wanted to sort of add lots of new content and stuff like that. And the first season, they had real support for it. And then subsequent seasons, I think other people became in charge of the CBC and were less interested in doing anything with Doctor Who, which is a shame. But Space came along and they have been amazing with it. I think the great thing about having with Doctor Who is that a lot of its popularity tied in with BBC America getting the property and it becoming much more successful in the States. And I think consequently it's just sort of exploded. And you know, it's really funny to me that, you know, when I see like the Entertainment Weekly, you know, website having, you know, photos of Grover in a 10th Doctor costume, you know, you're kind of like going, oh my God, we've really, really arrived in a way that hadn't. But in some ways, I'm not surprised. When Doctor Who was really big in the 1980s, in America, it probably would have had that same level of success and cultural knowledge had PBS networked the show and actually sort of showed it, like they showed Masterpiece Theater, like all PBS stations showed it, you know, Saturday at 7 or something like that, you know, instead of, you know, each one showing a hodgepodge, you know, one station showing it at 11 o'clock at night and the other one showing it weekly and weeknights at 6 and stuff. And if they had, then I think it probably would have had that same kind of cultural awareness. And I think because it was that popular long ago, and I think it's just come back again. And I think that's really great.
For some reason, I don't know if I'm remembering this correctly, I think TVO used to show old Doctor Who's, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They showed Doctor Who from about 1976, I believe, through to 1989, that was pretty much unbroken. Originally in the 70s, what happened was is that TVO basically had to show an educational remit for everything, and so they had to have someone sort of talk about the science or the themes in science fiction that appeared. And so they had, for the first several seasons, they had like Jim Dator, who was a scientist, sort of talk about sort of the science of certain episodes. And then after he left, after I think a season, they had Judith Merrill, who is a very well-known science fiction author, do it. She hated Doctor Who. It was quite obvious if you ever watched the this thing. So you can look them up on YouTube. She sort of has a vague contempt for it. But at the same time, it gave her a bully pulpit to talk about different ideas in science fiction and different ideas in science. And so, you know, it had that sort of educational dynamic. By about the early 80s, they did away with that, and they just showed it. And it was quite a good thing. And they only stopped showing because YTV sort of snatched the rights out from under them when they started in 1989. And they had it for about 5 years until Space had it. So, yeah.
Wow. It's amazing just to think that Doctor Who's been around for that long. It's always been on the fringe of my interest because I remember watching random episodes on TVO, but not knowing what the hell was going on because I was a child. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know why TV had it. And I knew Space picked it up, but it's hard to find Classic Who on television right now.
Yeah, it is. I think BBC Kids was showing it up until about a year or two ago, and I think that's gone away. Right now, if you live in the States, you're kind of lucky because every month BBC America is showing a classic episode from a different doctor with an accompanying documentary. That DVD is going to be out on DVD in July, I believe, and the documentaries are excellent. And they've shown, like, you know, classic episodes from the William Hartnell doctor, from the Troughton doctor. I think they're up to the Colin Baker doctor next month. And it's great. In Canada, you're less, they're not showing those on Space, unfortunately. So, but fortunately, I mean, most of the classic series is available in DVD now, and, you know, you can get it most places where you can get DVDs, and there's a lot of great stuff to watch. So, yeah, don't be afraid of the classic series. And the classic series is wonderful fun.
Yeah, like, actually, I got really bored, and I love all the digital kind of streaming services such as Netflix. And I recently figured out... Oh, they're my cat. Hi. I recently found out that they've got a bunch of episodes both in the U.S. and in Canada for different doctors. Though you get more in the U.S. than you do in Canada, I'm guessing, due to rights. And I was really sick last year, and I saw The Three Doctors, which is a 1970s era episode series, for those of you who aren't familiar. And I really discovered I really enjoy the Third Doctor. And I'd actually say he ranks probably in my top three doctors of all time, actually.
Oh, that's great to hear. I'm a big fan of John Pertwee's Doctor too. I love the Third Doctor. He, while we were writing our new book, Who's 50, I think one of the greatest joys for me while doing that was just to sort of watch a concentrated run of John Pertwee stories. We have several in it, and I was just so thrilled. It's just a very bright, colorful, fun show. You can sort of see a lot of what the modern series does has its origins in what the John Pertwee era did with Doctor Who. It was just sort of, you know, they wanted to, you know, it became a remit of let's do the most splashy, entertaining television we possibly can that will get bums on seats on Saturday nights. And that's the same remit that Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat now do today.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I like about the Third Doctor is he seems to be the same adventurous spirit as Matt Smith is. Mm-hmm. And that's just something that I didn't think I'd dig the old doctors because everyone's like, oh, it's the 70s, the 60s, blah, blah, blah. It's very cheesy 80s stuff. I don't know. Like, basically, they always tied it to the era and how cheesy it would be. But recently, I've been trying to get into older sci-fi and stuff that may necessarily be just a little off the beaten path. And surprisingly, the old Doctor Who stuff, while the special effects aren't fantastic, I find it's one of those shows where it doesn't take away from it. You're actually more intrigued by it than, like, anything else.
I think it's just a case of going in with different expectations. I mean, you know, it was a show that was shot in a TV studio with multiple cameras. It was shot like a soap opera, essentially, in what we would know as a soap opera in America. And it has a, you know, a very different kind of look and feel to it, and, you know, I wouldn't even say it's low budget. It's just a very different way of making film and making TV, and so, but it's very literate. It's very thoughtful. It's very witty. It's very funny. You know, the scripts are just superb, and, you know, and the acting is superb. I mean, I think every doctor has his own charm, and I think every actor who portrayed him, you know, brought something really special to the role. and you can sort of, and I think there's a real continuity between those. And, you know, David Tennant absolutely reveres several actors who played the Doctor, like Tom Baker and Peter Davison, and you can sort of see where he brings out elements of those in the thing. Matt Smith watched a Patrick Troughton episode from 1967 called The Tomb of the Cybermen while he was doing the preparing for the role, and he said, "Yeah, I want the Doctor to be more like that. I want him to be professorial with a bow tie, and I want all these sorts of things," because he saw, you know, that kind of interesting portrayal. And that's the great thing about the Doctor. He's not like, you know, a Captain Kirk Superman figure. He's more shambolic. He's a professor. He's a scientist. He sort of, you know, can be a bit scruffy, and I love that about him.
Yeah, like, because the Doctor's unlike any hero, at least in science fiction, that I've really come across. You're right. Like, it's not the Captain Kirk, I'm going to run in there with a phaser, blow it away, or Han Solo, shoot first, ask questions later sort of thing. And that's kind of why I like the way he faces off against his rogues gallery, which is absolutely huge. There's a book I got from DK Publishing a little while ago. It's the Doctor Who Character Encyclopedia. And it's like 200 pages of just all the different bad guys that he's run into over the years. And one of the bad guys I've taken a particular interest in, which I really think the new series has neglected, and that's the Cybermen for some reason. And I don't know why, because like, there's like, if you look at the new series, always with Daleks, which is cool because they're awesome looking bad guys.
Yeah.
And they're cool in and of themselves. But I guess my question to you, Graham, is why do you think the Cybermen are not getting as much attention during the new series as, say, some of the other bad guys?
I don't know. I think Cybermen's actually gotten, it had Neil Gaiman write an episode with him this year. So I think they're doing fairly well, actually. They actually, this season, they had a major updating in their look and how they're done. And I think that's going to be very interesting to see how they carry that over. The idea that that the Cybermen are now sort of stealthier and faster and can have, you know, greater computational power, I think is really kind of cool. I think the thing with Doctor Who is that everyone has a favorite monster, and to them, their favorite monster never quite gets the love they want. And someone will say, well, why hasn't the Zygons appeared in Doctor Who? Sooner or later down the road, the Zygons will show up, and they'll still say, why isn't the Zygons getting the love they want? You know, so I think everyone has a favorite, I'm a huge Dalek fan, and you know, there's a period where, you know, the best Dalek stories that they could come up with was Daleks in Manhattan. I'm like, going, why can't we have better Dalek stories? And then we have Daleks in the Asylum of the Daleks. So I do think these things work through.
Yeah, because I was kind of underwhelmed. Like, I love the two-parter we got where they introduced the parallel world Cybermen. I thought that was actually really, really clever. And we didn't see them again until the Pandorica opens, which admittedly was kind of awesome to see them all working together, like all the bad guys to trap the Doctor. I really thought that's probably one of my favorite episodes of the series. And I was actually saying to my wife, Doctor Who, at least recently, in the last couple years, there's almost points in the series where if they wanted to end it, it would almost work and I wouldn't feel bad about it. Mm. And I've never seen any other sci-fi show pull that off. And what I'm talking about specifically is at, I think the episode, it's after, basically, it's during the Pandorica storyline. Mm-hmm. And it's right towards the end where he appears at Amy's wedding and then takes off again.
Yeah,
that's the show could have ended right there, and I would have been okay with it. And I'd like to know why other sci-fi series can't give fans that intense sense of pleasure like no other. And that's, I've never seen that outside of Doctor Who, where literally anyone can jump in. Almost every episode is satisfying in some way. And I can't think of too many bad, truly awful episodes of the new series. There's a few that I don't like, but I can name multiple bad episodes of, like, say, Star Trek or other big popular shows. And I wonder how Doctor Who kind of gets around that.
I think Doctor Who gets around that because it is at its heart an anthology show, and every story is different. So one week you're going to have a Western, and the next week you're going to have a story with vampires, and the next week it will be something with it'll be a historical set in ancient Rome, and the next week it will be with, you know, giant dinosaurs that can talk. You know, it has that sort of infinite variety, and so I don't think you can ever get bored with it, which I think is the great thing about it. And it doesn't just sort of change its setting every week. It changes the type of story it will do. It will do a horror story like this season. You know, we'll do a horror story one week, and the next week it will do a journey to the center of the earth kind of exploration story. And the following week it will do a base under siege with the Cybermen coming. And you know, so every week it's got a different. And the next week it will do sort of an Avengers story that is set in Victorian times. So every week it's got a different genre. It's got a different kind of approach, and I think that always, you know, is great. And I think it means that there's always a jumping on point for people, and it doesn't ever exclude people, which is the great thing about it.
Now, one of the things that I'd love to pick your kind of brain about, and I kind of want to go through each of the new Doctors that have appeared since the reboot started. What did you think of the Eccleston era? Because I think he deserved at least one more season.
I think he deserved it too. I don't think it was, but I think it was more. It wasn't a case of him wanting to do it again. So I think it was just the problem. The problem was that he just didn't want to play the Doctor more than 1 year. And frankly, you know, if you're going to relaunch a show that had been off the air for 15 years, and you get an offer from one of the most well-known actors and one of the most well-known heavyweight actors in Britain that I would like to play the role for a year, I think any person in their right mind is going to say, oh yeah, sure, no problem. Because, you know, because it really did. It gave the show instant credibility with people in the public who'd never seen Doctor Who or hadn't seen Doctor Who in 2 decades. You know, and he's just such a great actor. And I think he just sort of brought such gravitas to the role. And I think he was able to sort of convey the new ways they were kind of going to do the character and sort of make the character a little bit slightly damaged and battle worn and have it be about the sort of relationship with him and Rose as it grows and as he sort of comes to trust someone again. And that's a beautiful story. I think that whole season is just perfect. I think there's only one really, you know, duff story among them, and even then I think it's just slower moving. You know, it's always got something going for it. Eccleston is always wonderful to watch. Billy Piper is never better. And it's just a lot of fun. And so, yeah, I love the Eccleston Doctor.
Yeah, because that was my first real dog, the one that I really developed an attachment to. Mm-hmm. And then I started going into the Tennant stuff. And that's something else. I find when you start going through all the different series and all the different stories is your favorite Doctor can change quite often. Mm-hmm. And this is a show I've never seen that really happen with. Like, you know, I mean, for example, with Star Trek, either, like, everybody has their favorite captain, but within the show, very rarely does a new captain come up, for example. Or maybe with Babylon 5, you had John Sheridan to the Bruce Brocksleitner character, where there was that transition. So you've really had a chance to grow with either the first guy or the new guy. And when I went into the Tennant stuff, I really got hooked on his style because it was more fun, more lighthearted. But I like how there was that don't fuck with me attitude in certain episodes. And I really like how I got a lot of emotional response back from the Tennant years.
Yeah, David Tennant is one of those wonderful actors. I think he's remarkably versatile, and he can do heavyweight dramatic scenes, and he can do comedy really well, and he sort of has the ability to sort of move between all these different things, and he's not really afraid of anything, and that's great as an actor. So, you know, you can have a story like Human Nature where he's playing a totally different character altogether from the Doctor, and you can have a story like New Earth where he's pretending to be, you know, Cassandra possessing him, or you can have a story like School Reunion where he's just totally steely with the Anthony Head character. And it's just wonderful. He has that real versatility to it. And I think, you know, the great thing about Doctor Who is that, you know, it sort of defies the expectation of a science fiction show, because, or especially a genre show that we, that, you know, that how we watch those now. You know, I think there, we're in an era of shipping and people really being intensely invested in the relationships between characters. And what happens is that the characters get changed, you know, every so often in Doctor Who, much, you know, so, you know, Companion doesn't last much longer than a season or two. And so, you know, then there's another one and a doctor suddenly changes and, you know, you're constantly having to sort of to change with the characters. And that's very counterintuitive to how, you know, we watch television now. I mean, you know, we watch, you know, something like, say, oh, not even science fiction. Like, you watch something like The Good Wife. You know, you're invested in what, you know, Juliana Margulies' character and Will are, you know, doing, and how that relationship is progressing. And you watch NCIS, and it's all about Ziva and Tony. And you know, we look at television in terms of relationships now. And Doctor Who does that, but Doctor Who also is willing to sort of go beyond that and cycle the characters in a way that defies expectations.
Another thing that I really liked about at least some of the kind of Tennant years is you got a lot of unexpected stories. And one episode always sticks with me in the fact that how sad it is, but how really good it is. And the fact that it doesn't have to be super sci-fi-y, it's the relationships between two characters. And it's the episode called The Girl in the Fireplace.
Mm-hmm.
And I never understood quite why that took with me so well.
I think it's a lovely love story, really, and it shows you what a love story for the Doctor would be like, and why the Doctor doesn't fall in love very often, because basically he progresses through time in a different way, and so people die and people grow old, and he doesn't live life linearly, and that's wonderful, and it's just a very beautiful kind of romance, and it's told so well, and I think at the same time it's got, you know, clockwork monsters and all these other great things. It's a beautiful story, and I just remember watching it and watching the closing speech where he's reading, where, you know, he's, you know, sort of in the TARDIS, and Rose says, well, why her? And, you know, she's saying, why are you in love with her and not me? And then she has to say, well, why her? Why did they select her? And then he says, she says, are you all right? And he just sort of goes, well, I'm always all right. And he has this look on his face that says, no, he's not. And Tennant is just so wonderful in that moment. It's just so beautiful, and then he listens to that. He reads the letter, and it's such an incredible kind of moment. It's a beautiful episode. I really, really love it. I really want to rewatch it, actually, now that I've talked about it.
And that's something else too. Like, you, like, with the new series of Doctor Who, like I said, like, unlike a lot of modern sci-fi, I find myself going back to episodes all the time. And sure, I've got favorite episodes of Star Trek or Sliders or Firefly, whatever. But with this, I don't know, it just seems different. And like you said earlier, it's because it's an anthology series, you can jump in almost at any point and be caught up with what's kind of going on. I think that's the kind of beauty of it. And it seems like that very much carried on with the Matt Smith era, because I think with a lot of the David Tennant stuff, I think you really became more emotionally invested in him than a lot of the other doctors, to be quite honest with you, because Tennant brought that really, that acting gravitas towards it, where you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Because I actually cried at the End of Time episode.
Yeah.
I didn't expect that. When he said, I don't want to go, and people were like, oh, that's so cheesy. No, that was the waterworks signal for me. And I'm not afraid to admit that, because the only other episode of television that's ever made me cry was the X-Files episode season 9, which admittedly was shit, was the episode where the lone gunman died.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay.
And that's the only time I've ever had a television show move me, and I didn't expect that.
I think the ending of The End of Time is wonderful, and I think there's this. I think the great thing about the Tennant Doctor is he's a very human Doctor. You know, I mean, the Doctor is a Time Lord and he's an alien, but you know, the sort of way he experiences emotion and the sort of, you know, things he sort of wants. The Tennant Doctor is very, very human, and I love that. And I love that when he comes to that final moment, he sort of says what all of us are going to say when we come to our own final moment. I don't want to go. And it's just the most beautiful expression I think you can have of who that doctor was. And then he changes again, and the great thing about Doctor Who is that it doesn't try to do the same thing twice. So you have Matt Smith's portrayal, and it doesn't try to do that kind of thing like David Tennant does. It's not grand and operatic and kind of trying to be more and more human. He goes and is more alien. He's more kind of at a 45 degree angle from the rest of us. And he's more strange. And I think that's a wonderful thing because it sort of shows you how different Doctor Who can be.
Yeah, like. Absolutely. Now, as we kind of begin to kind of close this out, Graham, I'd like your thoughts on the Matt Smith years, because everybody seems to love this guy, and a lot of people were kind of worried in the beginning, could he carry on after Tennant? And I think he's done so much with it, too. I mean, once again, every actor in the new series, they seem to one-up each other.
Yeah, they do, and I think the wonderful thing that I think anyone who watches Doctor Who for a long time does is, as soon as the new actor is cast, they immediately try to find the work of the new actor in something else and try to imagine him as the Doctor. And with Matt Smith, I watched him in a show called Party Animals, which is a show about two brothers who work in politics, and he's wonderful in it. He's just so versatile. I just thought that he's going to totally do the Doctor really well, and then he sort of came out and did the 11th Hour, and he was just so incredible out of the gate. It was just such a different. I couldn't even imagine how he would have played him, how he could have played it like that. And that was the great thing about it. He's a very canny actor. He has a very great sense of, you know, well, I want to do it kind of this way and different. And you know, he has a very good sense of how he wants to play the role, and he's very good at adjusting his energy depending on the script. So if it's a more of a kind of big colorful monster story like say Cold War this season, you know, he suddenly goes very big and he does the grand gestures and he's all, you know, big birdish in the way he sort of moves, and it's wonderful. But you watch a story like The God Complex, which is much more subtle and has much more going on, he suddenly gets very quiet and he's able to sort of do it, and he makes both seem natural, which is the wonderful thing. But he's very able to sort of vary his performance depending on the needs of the script, which is great.
Now, I'd like your opinion on, now this is a character I'm not particularly fond of, and I'm not precisely sure why, because she seems like a Mary Sue, like she's so much better than the Doctor, yet is mortal-ish, whatever. You can probably guess where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about River Song's involvement in the series so far?
Actually, I'm a big fan of River. I think the great thing about River is that she, if you're going to conceive of a character that's going to be the Doctor's wife, she has to be, in some ways, maybe not better than the Doctor, but she has to be able to be on top, so to speak. You know, she because, you know, the Doctor's relationships happen out of sequence, and she positively revels in that instead of saying, oh, woe is me, I'll she just sort of goes with it, and she loves the fact that she knows more than him at various points and stuff like that. And she's just sort of very kind of flirty, and you know, she's the sort of character that you could just imagine the Doctor having a relationship with in some way. You know, she just very, you know, she's very grand, and she's very larger than life, and so is the Doctor. You know, I know the criticism is leveled that she's a bit of a Mary Sue. I'm not entirely convinced. I just think that if you want to have a character that is more than a companion, that is going to have a sort of relationship with the Doctor and not end up, you know, being Amy or Clara or Rose or whatever, then it has to be something like River. It has to be sort of almost as grand and as huge as the Doctor is.
Do you think she'd be able to hold her own show like, say, Sarah Jane?
I think she would, but I wouldn't. I don't think we would need it. I think the way she works best is by doing recurring appearances. And I'm sure that, you know, if Stephen Moffat were to do a spinoff with her, I think it could be great fun. But I also think it would dilute the character in some ways. I think the great thing about Torchwood is that it it gradually sort of brought out new facets of John Barrowman. But the thing was, is that, you know, John Barrowman was always more fun when he was in Doctor Who. So I'm kind of, you know, I kind of think that she's just better off in Doctor Who in some ways, even though I think she could be done very easily in a show.
I'm kind of hoping against hope we'll see Captain Jack again, because Life Day was, or what was it?
Miracle Day?
Miracle Day. That was okay-ish. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed what I saw. Obviously, I like that character a lot more. And speaking of characters, I'd love to hear your thoughts on Amy and Rory with the transition to Clara.
I think Amy and Rory, they had a good run, and I think it's good that they've gone and moved on. I think that introducing someone very different who sort of has a different kind of energy like Clara is great. The arc around her and the mystery about her was interesting, and the great thing about it was that it was about the Doctor trying to figure it out in isolation to her, so she never was aware of it, so consequently we could just enjoy her. And I think she's wonderful in how she's just very bright and sparkly and just very fun, and I love that kind of enthusiasm, because the thing with Amy was that she always wanted to have the kind of mystique that she was capable of handling everything, and I think the nice thing about Clara is that she struggles with that, and she's not quite so in control of everything, but she's still very enthusiastic and bright, and I think General Louise Coleman is wonderful. I'm really excited about Clara. I think it was time for Rory and Amy to go, and I think that's perfectly fine. I think they should have gone in the God complex, honestly. I think they fully wrote them out then. I think the only advantage was that we got a couple more good appearances with them in Asylum of the Daleks and Dinosaurs in the Spaceship. But I would have been perfectly happy to have started with a new companion last fall.
Yeah, like honestly, I'm surprised the transition was handled so well, because I think the Angels Take Manhattan, once again, an episode that kind of got the waterworks going. When Amy says, "I'm like goodbye, Doctor," and he's like, "No, don't you dare! We'll figure this out." Once again, unexpectedly genuine performance from Matt Smith, where very much channeling that Tennant, very human aspect, that very much like you're losing your best friend. And like I said, really, really happy with the way things have been going. I mean, I thought season 6 in a lot of ways for me was a bit of a letdown. Mm-hmm. But season 7, I was really surprised how many episodes I genuinely enjoy. There hasn't been one where it was a chore to get through.
I think the approach to season 7 was great. It was this kind of idea that you sort of have a big kind of high concept that would go on a movie poster and then go from there. So you do a story like, you know, that's literally called Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. Or you do, you know, let's do a Western, or let's do a story with the Weeping Angels in New York. You know, it's all very high concept stuff, and it works really well. Let's do a haunted house story. Let's do Dune in Doctor Who. I think it was a great season. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. So I guess, Graham, final question. What's going to happen in the 50th? What do you think?
Your guess is as good as mine. I think I would be just happy if we have a fun adventure with some nods to the past, but at the same time, the same kind of fun and adventure and inventiveness and humor that made Doctor Who so great for the past 50 years. I mean, you know, that's sort of how I evaluate a good Doctor Who story. I mean, would I like to see, you know, Daleks and Cybermen and, you know, moment and clips from past Doctors? Sure, I would. But at the same time, what I want more is a really compelling story.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I'm really hoping they explain who this John Hurt character is supposed to be, whether he's that regeneration that they mentioned, that's his 12th and the 12th one is evil or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he's coming up on his 13th regeneration soon, how are they going to get themselves out of this hole? But then again, if the Master can get all his regenerations restored, there's no reason he can't.
Oh, indeed. Indeed.
So I'm hoping eventually the series takes that risk and gives us a female Doctor.
Yeah.
I think that would be friggin' awesome. Well, I guess when you look at it, River Song kind of was their attempt. Then again, there was the Time Lady, so... Mm-hmm. But still, I'm hoping.
It's true.
So I guess, Graham, final thing we got to talk about is what's this event going on Sunday, June 9th?
Oh, absolutely. There is a wonderful event going on June 9th. There's a man named Gary Russell. And Gary has been involved with Doctor Who in various ways over the past 20 to 30 years. He was an editor of Doctor Who magazine in the 90s. He wrote the novelization of the television movie and wrote literally the best book about the 1996 TV movie with Paul McGann. In the 2000s, he was the producer of the Big Finish audios, which are audio adventures of the classic Doctors, which were started in 2000 and have continued through to today. But he was executive producer of that range for 5 or 6 years. He's written the Doctor Who comic book for IDW, and he was script editor on the Sarah Jane Adventures, and he was the script editor on David Tennant's final specials, Planet of the Dead, The Waters of Mars, and The End of Time. And he also directed the two animated specials with David Tennant, The Infinite Quest and Neverland. So he's got a lot of experience with Doctor Who over the past 20 years, and he's written a lot of non-fiction books about Doctor Who, including Doctor Who the Encyclopedia, and he's also written many, many novels about Doctor Who. So he's a great, great, great writer, and a really great guy, and he knows so much about Doctor Who. He knows most of the actors who've played the Doctor at one time or another, and so he's wonderful, and we're bringing him in, and we're having an afternoon with him, and we'll be interviewing him, and we'll have him do a live commentary of one of the stories he was involved with, and there'll be a Doctor Who pub quiz. We'll have Doctor Who darts. It's going to be a fun afternoon. It's at Popper's Pub in Toronto, which is on Bloor Street near Bathurst Subway Station, and it's from noon until 6 o'clock. So please come out.
Yeah, and you can find out more information, guys, if you go to whopartytoronto.org. You can also find the event on Facebook. I will be there with my wife in attendance next Sunday.
Oh, excellent.
So I'm really looking forward to this. Just, if anything, for the commentary, getting the chance to meet other Doctor Who fans. And I'm looking forward to meeting older Doctor Who fans as opposed to kind of new ones, just because I want to hear their stories of their experiences with the Doctor. So I honestly think this is going to be fun. The event is $15 for the afternoon, $15 well spent, in my opinion. So be sure to check that out. Once again, whopartytoronto.org. And Graham, thank you for taking time out of your busy day to come speak to us here on This Week in Geek.
Oh, thanks so much, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right, guys. Well, that was my interview with Graham Burke, basically rapping about Doctor Who for the last 40 minutes. Really hope you guys come out and check this out. I'm actually hoping to interview Gary Russell once again to just talk about his involvement with Doctor Who. So hopefully I'll get that interview. We'll find out more closer to the date. But make sure you check out the links below to find out more information about this. Also, I'm also going to put links in there for Graham's books over at ecwpress.com/Doctor Who. Highly recommended. I think this should be pretty much on your couch while you watch some of the older episodes, and you'll gain some additional insights, and that's what's kind of fun. So anyway, guys, for This Week in Geek, I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd saying, live free or die hard, and we'll catch you guys again next time right here on thisweekingeek.net.
Want to see me make bubbles with my spit?
Sure do. In fact, that's the theme of our next show. So don't miss it.
What the hell happened to George Lucas?
Oh my God, there's snot on my face. And I'm your host, Mike the Birdman Dub. And I'm not a join. Not a join. What the f*** does that mean? F*** that. 10 seconds.
No, you gotta keep that.
Let's do this. Let's do this right the first time.
You guys. Ew, it's in my mouth. Oh, God.
Oh, what's it taste like, Mike?
Water. Ew, salty.
Let's start this episode with shat.
Okay, I'm good. Geico.
Holy shit.
Oh my gosh! Freak! Die! 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 Holy crap! Whoa! Whoa! Whoa, my god, whoa. Where did it go?
I'm like a stupid monkey.
As you can imagine, they don't let us out much.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Tune in next week to hear, somebody random. I don't know. Maybe even a hot chick. Yeah, let's go with that.
Did anyone ever tell you that you were very, very sexy?
How are you? Actually, no.
They never will.
Check out our website, thisweekingeek.net, for more geek content, as well subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head to this episode post on thisweekingeek.net and comment through Facebook Connect. Or you can call our voicemail line at 817-717-7202. Send us a Twitter message by @replying to @thisweekingeek. Lastly, you can email us at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. This extra music was produced by Prono Bozo at PronoBozo.com. We'll see you next time, and remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.